It's great to have your company. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. My name's Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Well, it's one of the defining stories of the 21st century so far, the threat of global terrorism. And it seems to dominate the news cycle more and more with attacks recently in Paris and Brussels, in Ankara and Istanbul and Tunisia, and a terrible one in Pakistan, just to name a few.
Naturally, then, this is something that looms pretty large for us. A recent Pew survey that was conducted across 40 countries looked at the global threats that people are most worried about. And in Australia, at least, Islamic State took top billing. 69% of Australians said that they were very concerned about ISIS, which was well ahead of something like climate change.
A lot of what we hear about when it comes to terrorism is the high-profile political stuff, the attacks that were successful, the war in Syria and Iraq, stories of people being radicalised and recruited to Islamic State. And something like the threat of terrorism can seem for most of us both, in a sense, very far away and yet very frightening. And the way this actually affects people is very local.
So in this episode of Life and Faith, we're thinking about how the global threat of terrorism translates into people's lives in local communities. We're going to look at what it means to live alongside Muslim refugees and talk to an expert who's involved in work that's happening on the ground trying to counter violent extremism.
We're also going to speak to a clinical psychologist about how we as individuals and collectively can deal with fear and anxiety as a response to the threat of terrorism. But first, here's Richard Schumach. He's a research fellow here at the Centre for Public Christianity and a philosopher of religion. For years, he lived and worked with Muslim communities in Melbourne. And he warns against a mindset of us versus them, goodies versus baddies, when people in the broader community are engaging with their Muslim neighbours. So Richard, part of this discussion appears to be a sort of a fear of refugees, because some people assume that among this group will be extremists, and there's this threat of terrorism that we're all conscious of.
Absolutely. And there is a very slight risk, and it's real and present, that there are people who have an Islamist mindset are part of that refugee community. It's a very real risk, but a very small risk, I think.
What about the discussion around how Islamic this is? Sometimes people say, look, authentic Islam has nothing to do with this. Others have a different view. What's yours?
The question of how legitimate or how authentically Islamic the actions of ISIS, for example, or any Muslim who would like to use violence to promote Islam, that's a real and live question for Muslim communities, and they discuss it a lot. The reason for that is, and you can't get away from this, is that the authentic texts of Islam, particularly the Quran, but also the traditions that record the example of Muhammad, they endorse the use of violence in the name of religion and in terms of promoting the faith. It's also true that Muhammad exercised violence. He was the head of an army as well as being the judge and the prophet of that community. The Quran has very clear commands that you should pick up swords and fight. Now, it's true that many Muslims these days will say, well, that was for back then, not for now, or they'll say, well, that was metaphorical, not real. There are ways that different Muslims read in that history, but it certainly remains the case that if you want to appeal to those verses, I think you can make a strong case that it's genuinely Islamic.
Right, so as you talk about that community having to wrestle with this, and the Muslim community do this, because of course most Muslim people are not at all violent.
Oh, absolutely. And there's been a lot of research that's been put into Muslim communities, and the vast, vast majority, 85-90% of Muslims have no interest in using violence. They're not buying into terrorism or Islamist agendas. It's only a very small percentage that have any support for that, and even a much, much tinier percentage who are actually willing to do anything about it.
So if we think about recruitment to something like Islamic State, do you have a sense of why that kind of thing is attractive, like particularly to young people? Is this a matter of some people being disenfranchised and that's why these kinds of ideologies are compelling? How strong is the religious element?
Well, I like that you ask about ideology, because the agenda of ISIS is very much a political and a theological ideology, and the people who buy into it and who travel over to join in, what they see themselves joining into is a new state, and they have an ideal of creating this beautiful Islamic country that is operating under this perfect model of how Islam operates. So it's very ideological. Now, some of them are disaffected. Some of them are people who would love that to happen here, but they can't see it here. Some of them are thugs who just like to pile on and they enjoy a fight. But it's certainly true that it's an ideologically or a theologically driven agenda. And friends of mine who I knew in the Muslim community who were interested in going, in this case to Afghanistan, not so much Iraq, they were some of the nicest Muslims I knew, and the reason they wanted to join the fight was to establish justice. Now, I think that's a distorted way of thinking about it, but that in their mind, that's what they're doing. They're not thinking of it as terrorism. They're thinking of it as a fight for justice.
So as a Christian person who has engaged with Muslims who are attracted by this kind of ideology, do you feel like there are things that Christianity has to offer in how we have this discussion and how we combat radicalization and that kind of thing?
Absolutely, Christianity and Christians have something to offer, particularly in being able to speak to Muslims about that ideology, that mindset, that way of thinking about God and religion. You need to understand that Islam, certainly traditional Islam, it's about rules. Muslims keep rules and they try and enforce rules on their community because that's how you create a good community. Whereas Christianity, the centre is it's about grace, and lives are changed not by force from the outside, making people do things. Lives need to be changed from the inside. It's about changing hearts. And ultimately, only God can do that. And from a Christian perspective, it's the message about Jesus that brings people to life from the inside. That's a unique thing that Christians have to offer to Muslims. So we can say, yeah, faith is fantastic, and the religious life is a great life. But here's a better way, a way that's full of grace.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. If you've just joined us, we're talking about countering terrorism. And we're not talking about guns or bombs or drones. Instead, we're looking at community engagement, relationship building, and trust.
We often feel pretty helpless as we read about things like the rise of Islamic State and how resourceful they've proven in using social media to spread their message and sign up new recruits. We constantly hear stories of families around the world who find that their children are being recruited by ISIS. In Australia, at least 100 families are grappling with this problem, with young people who've left their lives in Australia for the conflict zones of Syria and Iraq.
But those efforts are also being thwarted in creative ways. There are people who are responding to this on a grassroots level around the world. The Australian Intervention Support Hub, for example, is a new initiative that brings together government departments, community groups, religious leaders, academics, and police to develop effective approaches to countering violent extremism.
So joining us is Greg Barton, Chair in Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University in Melbourne and co-director of the Australian Intervention Support Hub. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Now, I wonder if you could talk about the typical pathways, if there are such things, towards radicalisation and violent extremism that you've identified. Is it possible to identify some pathways there?
Well, I think you're quite right to flag the word typical and question it. There's a lot of variation, certainly in terms of background of individuals. When it comes to the pathway, though, there is a common factor, and that is that almost invariably individuals are radicalised through peer networks, through social networks. But very often, and we've seen this in the Australian case, we've got young people who have been approached by somebody either physically or online in chat forums. They've expressed interest and this person has befriended them and presents themselves as a kind of friend and mentor. And that friendship tends to be the initial point of moving towards more extreme ideas. It's not the ideas themselves that move people in the first instance, by and large. It's a sort of social relationship. And then once you've formed new friends, you then reframe and internalize those ideas to fit into the friendship circle. And that's what happens in lots of areas of life where people make shifts in terms of conviction, in terms of religious orientation. It certainly happens in the area of violent extremism.
We sometimes hear people talk about grooming when it comes to abuse, but would this be a term you could use in what you've just described?
Yeah, grooming is not something that applies in every case. It sounds a bit extreme to talk about grooming, but it is actually very much the case that individuals are often identified because they're asking questions in an online chat room or other ways expressing interest, and somebody invests time in befriending them in what to them appears to be genuine friendship, but really, frankly, is just grooming in the way that people are groomed in other areas of life. We see this with pedophiles, but even with adults in looking for love and relationships online, people can try and cultivate a sense of trust and a sense of friendship, which is really false. But very often, parents of kids who are discovered being radicalized from fairly regular families, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, are surprised by what's happening. When they look back, they can see warning signs, but it turns out somebody reached out to them and befriended them, often through social media or online, and basically groomed them, basically invested in the friendship to the point where they became manipulated into completely shifting their outlook and their associations.
This sounds like something that, you know, it's very individual and quite under the radar often, and it's hard to know what you can do to counter that. Can you give us some examples of international best practice in this? How have other countries done well at preventing radicalization?
Well, the first thing to acknowledge is that this is still a very new field. No one has really figured out how this works and got all the answers. And it looks like as if there will never be a singular answer. This is a very complex thing. But we are seeing some really enlightened policy in Northern Europe, in Scandinavia. The Danes, for example, have done some really good work, including working with people who have come back from fighting in Syria, repentant and genuinely having had change of heart, and having been assessed by security authorities as being genuine. They're used to warn others. And this builds on an insight developed through a series of programs across Northern Europe called the Exit Programs. So Exit Deutschland in Germany, for example, or Exit Sweden, began working with people who were in danger of being radicalized into neo-Nazi extremism, and worked with so-called former neo-Nazis to dissuade and to engage one-on-one or in small groups. Another side of this work is just generally building social cohesion and resilience, and that means trying to make sure that there are less and less young people who are feeling alienated and without friends. In other words, if people are busily engaged, it may only be a weekend sports club, but something that keeps them plugged into a social network, they're less vulnerable. So that's not targeted. That's just sort of general good work to be doing in society. The good thing about this is that it's generally beneficial to the society, quite regardless of concerns about terrorism.
So that's the kind of thing that is happening here in Australia? Is that the kind of work that the Hub is doing?
That's the sort of work that we're working towards doing. It's frustrating for everyone that we're not further down this path than everyone would like to be. State and federal police do a lot of this intervention work. They have intervention groups. But they themselves have been expressing now for several years that they want to move this intervention work to a partnership that goes beyond just police community engagement. And so the Hub, or the Australian Intervention Support Hub, is set up to try and build the capacity in community groups, working with existing social service providers, working with existing community groups, to get awareness, first of all, of the warning signs of radicalization, and then to develop points of access to get assessment and help, and then to get expert teams together to do this intervention. And there is some work being done already, but frankly, this problem with Islamic State over the last 2 years has developed much more rapidly than anything we've seen before. It's a much larger scale. So the work that needs to be done now is, you know, beyond anything we've had experience with in the past.
What's the responsibility of Western governments and other institutions, and what's the responsibility of the Muslim communities in this endeavour to counteract radicalisation?
Well, I think the best way to frame this is that this should, in my opinion, be seen alongside other areas of risk to young people. And we're talking primarily about young people, so the vast majority under the age of 30 and a disturbingly large number under the age of 20, including teenagers who are enrolled in schools. There are many risks that young people face. So sexual abuse, struggles with alcohol and substance abuse, struggles with mental health, which, you know, any of these areas where we see somebody struggling, we have anyone working with young people has an obligation to not close their eyes to what they see happening, but to reach out and try and find help for a person who is struggling. Recruitment to a group like Islamic State used to be extremely uncommon. It's become disturbingly more commonplace for many community groups over the last 2 years. It's still a fairly rare phenomenon, but it needs to be added to these other threats to the well-being of young people. So if we say it's just the work of government, or it's just the work, in this case, of Muslim community groups, we're going to miss the mark. It can't be just the work of any one section of society. This is really, you know, genuinely a whole-of-society response.
You've spoken about radicalisation generally, like political radicalisation and so on, but what does the kind of religious layer in this case mean for this endeavour?
I think it helps to understand that we're dealing with a social phenomenon. So the question of ideology and religious belief tends to come in secondarily. So when community groups say, we don't believe it's our religious faith, or we don't believe it's Islam that's the problem, there's substantial truth to that perception. On the other hand, a group like Islamic State is itself a strange hybrid. It, at one level, is an apocalyptic cult. And like other religious cults that we're familiar with, it distorts people's perceptions and their horizons and their worldview to the point where they lose track of broader societal values and a sense of what it is to be normal. But it begins with this friendships. It begins with the social relationships. So we understand that the friendships come first and the ideas are then internalized as people try and associate with a new circle of friends. We can understand that we need to respond to this where people are being targeted, and we need to respond to it by providing alternative social networks that can protect them and form some sort of safeguard against recruitment. So recognizing it's a hybrid phenomenon, that it's not purely religious and that this is not simply a case of dangerous religious ideas, they're certainly there. It means that we are in a better position to form genuine partnerships and talk to each other in respectful ways.
So, Greg, do you think that Christian groups and organisations, including churches, have a particular role to play in this?
Yeah, there's a lot that Christian groups can do. Firstly, we made this distinction between targeted interventions and general work towards social cohesion. So voluntary associations in which religious communities tend to lead the way, and churches have done a lot of work over the years, voluntary associations can do a lot when it comes to social cohesion to try and help new migrant communities feel better integrated, particularly working with young people, just the practical things that build a sense of community and a sense of belonging. And those values often described in terms of cohesion and resilience. Christian churches, obviously, there's a limit to what they can do when it comes to targeted interventions if it's somebody beyond their own community. But in the area of social service delivery, a lot of the social services that work with young people come out of connections with churches. And there is space there with sensitivity to be providing help, because we're dealing with some of the same issues that arise when somebody falls in, you know, with a bad crowd when it comes to drug and alcohol problems or juvenile delinquency. So some of the same sorts of social services can be part of the solution. But obviously, if that is to work, there needs to be real trust and respect between agencies that might have a Christian church connection and Muslim community groups. And of course, at the moment, there's generally not a lot of that going around. So that's something we have to work harder at. And I think that means that one of the things that Christian churches need to take to heart is they need to better understand the problems and, you know, better understand Islam and Muslim communities in general if they really want to do some constructive work in this space.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. We're talking about terrorism and the various ways we can counter it at a local community level.
Obviously, the idea of terrorism is to make people afraid. Its stated goal is to spread terror. So as global politics goes, this issue has an almost unique emotional dimension. What does it mean to feel terror, to feel fear, in response to what is, for most of us, quite an abstract issue? And if that is the goal of the terrorists, well, it certainly seems like we're playing along with their aims if their actions change how we live or think or speak. So how can we process the fear and anxiety that many of us feel as a result of terrorist attacks, both individually and together?
To guide us through these questions, we have in the studio clinical psychologist Lisa Aitken. Welcome back in the CPX, Lisa.
Thank you, Simon.
What do we need to know about fear and anxiety and what those things do to us?
One of the things we know about anxiety is that it changes how we think. And we're all aware of the physical symptoms of anxiety, our heart pounding, our stomach swirling. And it's really useful if, for example, you're being chased down a dark alley at 2 a.m, you want your body to do all this. And what a lot of people don't realise is that our thinking shifts as well whenever we're fearful or anxious. So our frontal part of our brain, which is where our big picture sort of philosophizing about life lives, shuts down and our limbic system kicks in. And this is about survival. Again, really useful if you're being chased down a dark alley at 2 a.m. You don't want to be philosophizing about life. But if it's another type of threat, for example, a fear of terrorism, of a random attack, it's not very useful because we're trapped inside thinking which over-focuses on the risk. The other thing that happens is collectively, people become more ethnocentric. There's a lack of tolerance of diversity. And then when you add that to what's happening individually, that you're getting a greater perception of risk than is perhaps realistic, it's a tricky scenario.
Do we understand why it is that we have kind of a disproportionate fear of certain things like terror attacks? You know, we're much more likely to die on the roads or
Absolutely.
Illness, but
yeah.
we have this kind of real intense anxiety about events like that. Why do we disproportionately focus on these things?
Yeah, well, part of it is it's a threat, and it is a threat. And so our brain is doing this big shift that our prefrontal cortex, which is where nice, clear mathematical calculations of risk live, isn't working very well. And it's all about the emotional response. Our limbic system's activated. I think it's also, there are places that we think we're safe, an airport, a coffee shop, a concert, and there's something just emotionally
really jarring
yeah. and scary because it's unpredictable, and why it would just be, you know, wrong place, wrong time. And emotionally, that we don't cope well with uncertainty and unpredictability in life as humans, and so that adds to this weight.
Last year I read an article that talked about the animals that are most likely to kill you. And it was looking at, you know, is it safe to go to the beach because of shark attacks?
Mm.
And looked at all the ways you're likely to be killed in America over summer. And by far the greatest risk were cows.
Good heavens.
Statistically.
yeah.
The cow that's going to fall on you when you're yeah. milking it or whatever. And then when you looked at how many people were killed by sharks compared to who were killed on the road, it was, you know, it was unbelievably different.
Yeah.
But most people get in the car and don't fear that.
Mm.
So that can help to some degree. But then there are others of us who, getting in the water, the fear just overcomes them, right? It's the stats at that
That's
point
right.
don't help.
Very relevant. And look, you might find yourself going off to see a psychologist at that point if you really want to get in the water, and fear of sharks or fear of whatever is an issue. The general gist with anxiety in psychology is work out a way not to avoid what you're anxious of, because it's often the avoidance that is problematic. Now, if you never need to go in the water, then having a fear of sharks is neither here nor there. But if you love going in the water, then you're going to have to face the fear. And in the same way, if a fear of a terrorist attack on a plane is stopping you getting on a plane, and actually you need to get on a plane for whatever reason, then it's managing the anxiety that's the issue. And so that is about learning to not avoid and to do life as you would have normally. You know, when you see on TV reports after a terrorist incident, and they just interview random people who are around, and often they say things like, I'm not going to let this change my life, because then the terrorists will have won, because then I will be scared. And actually, in terms of managing anxiety, it's a good thing
That's
to
a
do.
Good
just
approach.
Yeah, just yeah. keep doing life as normal and don't avoid, because every time you avoid doing something you're scared of, you give yourself the message, the only reason I'm safe is because I avoided it. Not actually, it's statistically very unlikely. You learn that by doing those things, and then, oh, nothing bad happened.
So Lisa, what are some other useful ways that people can process thoughts and emotions, either in the aftermath of a terror attack or other sort of anxiety-inducing things?
I think it's okay if you know that you're getting really upset, it's okay to have a news break, to just, you know, steer clear a bit of the news. There's in the literature, there's a lot of debate around, is watching this sort of thing vicariously, you know, reading about it, is it actually traumatizing? And there's floating around this idea of not just post-traumatic stress, but it's almost like with fear of terrorism, pre-traumatic stress. We're always anticipating it, and that elevates our levels of anxiety. So sometimes you just need a break from reading about it or watching it, and just let yourself calm down. And the other thing is staying connected, that people who have really good social connections, social support, tend to cope, well, they cope better with life in general, but even specifically with this fear of terrorism.
What about children and talking to them about these sorts of incidents? It's very hard to protect them from them completely.
Yeah, you can't, can you?
Boy, we didn't talk about when this Belgium attack occurred, but, you know, he went to school and he found out about it a couple of days after. But what are the good ways of helping them to process these things?
I think you can use some of the same skills that we use with kids with anxiety in general. So there's a lovely idea about detective thinking, looking for evidence and asking, so in your day, you know, were there any terrorists in your in the last year, in your world? And so I guess you're helping them look at evidence in terms of actually the risk is really low. But it's also confronting, isn't it, for kids to come to grips with that there's evil in the world and that people can do horrible things to people. And I guess you explain that in the same way as you explain it. If there's a bully in the school and someone's doing something horrible, how can people do terrible things? And you might want to minimise. You don't want to overexpose them to it because it has to be put in a context.
What role does personal faith or, you know, being part of a faith community have in dealing with these kinds of fears and anxieties?
Being in a faith community gives you a particular worldview, and it, from a Christian perspective, the worldview would be an expectation that the world being fallen is not always safe, and yet that there is a God who at the end of the day is in control of what happens and who will bring justice in the end. And a Christian perspective would be that God doesn't promise to protect us from all harm, but that there's a way of living, and a way of living that's in the direction of love and compassion and mercy and not getting caught up in hatred and bitterness in response to this. That I think faith communities, and I guess I speak from a Christian community perspective, that we do well to encourage each other, but I'm sure other faith communities would have this same idea. We do well to encourage each other to keep heading towards a path of compassion and forgiveness. And it is not just compassion for the victims, which of course it comes naturally to every human being, but equally of forgiveness of the perpetrators of violence. And all human beings, we're going to struggle with this in-group, out-group effect which happens when we're faced with violence and death. And the challenge that Jesus set before his people was that you need to love your enemies. So we have a sense of a God who dies in solidarity with victims. He himself was a victim of violence. But as he dies, he says, Father, forgive them about the perpetrators. And it's a deep challenge for anyone who holds that position of how do I look at terrorists as still humans who are in need of forgiveness.
You've been listening to Life and Faith. If you liked this episode and want to hear more from us, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just type Centre for Public Christianity in the search box to find us. Next week, it's Music and the Mind. Hope you'll join us then.